I remember the words once spoken by the British historian Arnold Toynbee, who said, "Most people have not rejected Christianity. They have simply rejected a caricature of Christianity." And what he meant by that was that most people have never really been exposed to the authentic thing. They've never seen the real thing. They hear about it. But how many non-Christians are really exposed to authentic Christianity? That's a good thought for us this morning. And I would simply ask each one of us to really examine ourselves. What kind of a character do we portray in our relationships with non-Christians? Paul uses the language here of putting away, putting it off like an old garment. And last week, I stood up here and I told you how well dressed I was and how long it's taken for many people to get me out of my old farm clothes to where I begin to look presentable up here on Sunday morning. And it was a spoof. And I think most of you understood that. Not everybody, but most of you understood that. I am sure that there are some of you who thought that I was bragging about how well-dressed I am and that I'm dwelling too much on appearances. I'm not into appearances. Those who are closest to me will tell you that. Frankly, that's a concern of my wife and others, that I'm not into appearances. You can hardly crawl into our car and my truck sometimes for all the dirt and the leaves and everything else have been drugging over the years that somehow just never been vacuumed out. And I drive an old 9-year-old pickup, and Connie drives an 8-year-old car, and we still live in the same house that we lived in shortly after we came here, and we're not into appearances. Now, I hate to have to apologize for that, but I realize in a church our size that some of you can misunderstand that, and it happened this week. And I apologize to you because we are not, believe me, into appearances. But by the same token, Paul uses the language here representing putting off dress, putting on a new dress. We talk about, there's books that have been written on dressing for success, and they've proven that the way you dress can determine to some extent how you are going to succeed in your chosen vocation. If you go to apply for a job, even though you may have long hair and you may run around in jeans, and frankly, I don't care how you dress on Sunday morning. I don't care if you don't wear a tie. I don't care if your tie is tied clear up to your neck. I don't care if it hangs down to your knees. I won't even notice, frankly. Connie, in fact, every now and then will have a dress on. I say, "Dear, is that a new dress? Did your mom buy you a new dress?" She says, "I've only had it for 6 months. Worn it probably 12 times. I just don't notice those things." But many of you do. And we talk about dressing for success in order to present the right kind of an image to others. Now, Paul uses that language then in connection with our own inward dress. And he's talking about the things that ought to inwardly be a part of us, a part of the makeup of an authentic Christian. What does an authentic Christian look like? And that's what Paul is addressing in these verses. Now, with that in mind, I want to address three commands that Paul gives in these verses this morning. And we'll be as brief and yet as thorough as we can. Number one, if we're going to be authentic as God's people, we need to put away lying and start telling the truth. We need to put away lying and start telling the truth. Look at verse 25. "Therefore, putting away lying." And in the Greek, it really implies here, be done with it once and for all. Let lying no more be a part of your Christian makeup. That is no longer you. You were once a liar. You were once under the father of lies. You were once the son of the father of lies, who is Satan, according to John chapter 8 and verse 44. With him, lying began. The whole world is caught under this one big lie because Satan is the master of lies. And we once belonged to him. We were once in his domain. Therefore, it would only be natural that we would be liars before we came to Christ. And that's why 90% of the American people lie on a regular basis. But Paul says, you be done with it once for all as God's people. Lying began at the fall when Satan lied to Eve. And lying has been a characteristic of unregenerate humanity ever since that time. You could probably say the history of the world is the history of lies. Look at the lies that have been told in our own century. And lies that are now trying to be corrected by the history books, and lies that are being perpetrated now in changing the history books to cover up events that actually happened in the past that we no longer want our children to know about. Lie upon lie upon lie. David lamented the society in his day, and our society is no different. The unregenerate, the non-Christians, have always been characterized by lying. David lamented in Psalm chapter 12, in verse 1, he said, "Help, Lord, for the godly man sees it. The faithful have disappeared from among the sons of men." Everyone is speaking lies to one another. David lived in that kind of a society. Who can you believe? What can you believe anymore? And that's what the master deceiver has perpetrated upon us, that we're all a bunch of liars before we come to Christ. Can you imagine what would happen if everybody in the world started telling the truth? Just think about it for a moment. I venture to say economies would probably collapse because many economies, including our own, are built upon a heap of lies. Look at the advertising and television. If people are really truthful about their products and what they do, if beer companies were really truthful about the negative effect that drinking has upon the human body, the shrinking of the brain, we've got a story right here in our own city where an heir to a major fortune in alcohol has destroyed his brain through alcohol. But we don't. That doesn't sell, so we have to make it look more appealing. It's a way of life. The verb here, by the way, is a present active participle, speak. Speak the truth. It means let truth become a habitual way of life with you. And when you find yourself not telling the truth, go back and correct it. Now, I'm speaking to myself because I tell you, and everybody else close to me knows that I have a tendency to exaggerate and embellish and just to make the stories more interesting. But it really turns out to be non-truth when it's finished. I say that, now you're going to not know what to believe. And I guess that's probably why some might have misunderstood my spoof on dress last week. You thought I was serious. But Paul's point is, let truth become a habitual way of life with you. Put it into practice. What he's really saying is practice, 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 practice truth. Let it become a habit ingrained in you. All your life, he's really implying, you were a liar and you practiced lying. Now begin to practice truth. It's not something that comes automatically. You may have a desire to be truthful, and hopefully you do when you come to Christ. You say, I really want to speak the truth, but you find it difficult. With a non-believer, he doesn't care whether he speaks truth or not, as long as he isn't taught. But for believers, it's very important that we begin to practice truth. We were with a couple out in California in July. We flew out there to spend time with him. And I used to be here at Wayside years ago. He's now an oncologist out in Riverside, California. And he'd never played golf before, but his pastor played golf, and he knew I played golf. And he thought, boy, to really be a good host for Stephen County, I need to play golf. And he went out and never had a golf club in his hand. Literally, he never had a golf club in his hand. He goes out to play golf with us. And the poor guy did this 3 days in a row. I said, John, you don't have to do this. He said, no, I want to play golf. And each day he got a little bit better at it. And I said, John, you know, you could really be a good golfer. I did a terrible thing to him. I got him into golf. I said, because he doesn't do anything for exercise. And his wife was concerned about that. And through my influence, the influence of his pastor, we got him playing golf. And Debbie told us here just a few weeks ago, she says, John has gone crazy over golf. Went out and bought a new set of golf clubs and everything to go with golf. And she said, this guy is so radical about learning this game. He's 45 years of age. That at 3 a.m. in the morning, she says, I've caught him out in the backyard practicing his swing. What he is trying to do is develop a swing that will become natural and become habitual. And that's the desire of every golfer. And if you've ever picked up the game of golf or you're in the process, that's what you want to do, and you are determined to develop a habit. Now take that and apply it to lying. If we were just as determined to practice the truth and to speak the truth as we are in picking up a game, if we were that determined, before long we would all be speaking truth to one another. In fact, Dr. Johnson, the literary writer, used to say, by way of advice in bringing up children, this is great advice for children, accustom your children constantly to telling the truth. If a thing happened at one window and they, when relating it, say that it happened at another window, do not let it pass. But instantly check them. You do not know where deviation from truth will end. It is more from carelessness about truth than from intentional lying that there is so much falsehood in the world. Truth demands a deliberate effort. I couldn't help but think of that. Our little granddaughter Kelsey a few weeks ago caught her very first fish. She's 2.5 years of age. You ask her now about that fish and she'll say, everything's really, really, it was a really, really big fish. And all at once her hands go out as far as they'll go. We had Randy Draper, the pastor from Maranatha Baptist Church, and his wife Darlene over to the house last Monday night, along with Gerald and the group that went to Uganda. And we just had a great time, cookout and fellowship with them. And our little granddaughter sitting there in front of Rander as we're talking, and Rander's got one of these infectious laughs. They had a 40th surprise birthday party for him yesterday, and Claude Black, the black pastor that's so well known here in the city, spoke, and I spoke, and several others, just to say, hey, this guy is a great guy. And it was just a real choice time. Anyway, he's there Monday night and he breaks out in this infectiously loud laugh, and little Kelsey looks up at him and she says, that's loud. That's really, really loud. Of course, what could I say? But we need to really be people who practice the truth. And we must develop that as a habit. If you catch me lying, you need to call me on it. And I do lie now and then. I'll be honest about it. I exaggerate. Dave Hocking, who's now on the radio here, we heard him speak several months ago at a seminar, and he said, I have to take these tapes of what I am speaking to you guys and send them back to the men I meet with, and they will listen carefully to these tapes just to be sure that I am telling the truth and not embellishing or exaggerating my stories. Because he wants to be a man who practices the truth. Is truth that important to you? Evidently it is to our Christian clothing, or Paul would not have mentioned it here. Why should we do this? Look at verse 25. The reason is, for we are members one of another, that's why. And members of the body cannot lie to one another, otherwise you have a disaster in the making. And I think this has happened. All across America, in American churches, because of all the lies that have been told by pastors and church leaders and the Christians, all over the place, because of a lack of really being truthful with one another. You're hurting, you're not being truthful about it. Your marriage is crumbling beneath you, you're not being truthful about it. You're saying, when somebody asks you, how you doing? Oh, great. All at once you find out, they're no longer living together. Speaking truth. Why? For we are members one of another. Can you imagine what would happen if the body, my members of my body begin to lie to my mind about what was going on, if my nerve system began to lie? And my nerves told my brain that this particular thing that I'm about to stick my hand in is cold, when in reality it's really hot. It would destroy the hand. That's what happens with leprosy, you see. The nerve endings become so damaged that they send wrong signals to the brain, and you can end up destroying the members of your body because of that very thing. We see it in other diseases today as well. And the body of Jesus Christ can be destroyed when members are really not honest and truthful with one another. That's why I keep pumping these small groups, because there's where you can be here this morning and you can just be full of lies, and you can be fostering lies and spreading lies. But when you're in a small group and you're accountable to people in a small group situation, all at once there's a little more accountability that's there. And you know, we do a great disservice to young Christians when we, as older Christians, say, we really don't have any problems. We've got it all together. It's a lie. We can lie by what we don't say as well as what we say, by not really speaking the truth with one another. Well, enough on that. Number two, be angry without sinning. Verse 26. Be angry without sinning. Be angry and do not sin, a quote from Psalm 4:4. Do not let the sun go down in your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Now, I think that this area probably sets us apart from unregenerate humanity as much as anything does. There is a righteous anger, and that's why he says, be angry, but do not sin. There's also an unrighteous anger. But in either case, we're not to let, even if it's a righteous anger, and I'll qualify what that is in a moment, we're not to let that control us. We're not to let the sun go down upon it. Otherwise, that anger can cause us to do some incredibly destructive and evil things to one another. What is a righteous anger? I think one of the best examples of it is in John chapter 2, when we see Jesus, beginning in verse 13, going into the temple, driving out the money changers, because you see, these money changers were like many money changers around the world today. They were taking advantage of the poor people who were coming in, had traveled a great distance. They had to buy the animal or the bird, the turtle dove, to be sacrificed, and they were in the process of exchanging their money from one currency to another. They were taking advantage of the poor people. And when Jesus saw how the temple of God was being maligned, when he saw how God was being maligned, when he saw how the people were being oppressed and mistreated by the money changers, it made him extremely angry, and he went in there and he turned over their tables and he threw the money changers out. That's a righteous anger. There's a lot of things that make me angry today and ought to make us all angry. I get angry today when I see people oppressed. I get angry today at some of the racial attitudes that we perpetrate from one generation to another against other races. I get angry when I see that. I get angry at abortion today. And to me, that's a big issue in this upcoming political campaign that every one of us as God's people ought to be concerned about. I get angry when I see that the innocent unborn child is given absolutely no rights. No consideration. I saw a bumper sticker recently that reads like this, pro-choice, what a lie. Babies never choose to die. We need to wake up on that. We need to be angry. But we must be careful how we handle that anger. We can handle it wrongly, and that's also a concern I have for all who are involved in the pro-life ministry. That we not allow the anger to control us. I think that's what this passage is saying. We ought to be angry at pornography and drug abuse and alcohol abuse and wife abuse and child abuse and every other kind of abuse and misuse because of the terrible things that it does to men and women and children who are created in the very image of God. It ought to make us angry. We ought to be angry at how Satan deceives people into adultery and fornication and divorce and every other act that is a violation of the covenant relationship made between a man and a woman before God. That ought to make us angry. God says, I hate divorce. He hates a lot of things. And there are things that we need to hate, even though they happen. Makes me angry to see the kind of sex education that is being offered in our schools today that often do nothing more than promote sexual licentiousness among our teenagers. It really makes me angry because I believe the terrible consequences have already begun to set in our society. And I'm not sure but what it may be too late to turn it back. Only a spiritual awakening, only the hand of God can bring change about in our society. And the list is endless. We have plenty to make us angry. What then is unrighteous anger? This is where it really gets more personal. Unrighteous anger is when wrong has been inflicted against us. And we get angry. And we all do, don't we? Your wife wrongs you. Your husband wrongs you. Somebody says something about you. You get angry. You feel like, I've been hurt. It becomes a selfless kind of anger. A selfish kind of anger. Not a selfless kind of anger. You see, the anger that Jesus had in John chapter 2 in driving the money changers out of the temple and overturning their tables was that he was angry at how this was maligning the very name of God. He was angry at how the poor people were being oppressed. It was a selfless anger. But on the other hand, when he was being inflicted with all kinds of abuse, when he was being nailed to a cross, he could say, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. That is selfless anger. Are you angry today because your spouse did something to you? And you may not even be talking this morning. You're talking to everybody else, but not your spouse. Hey, I know, I've been there. Connie and I have been there many times past year. I used to take my anger out by becoming silent. I know some of you have trouble picturing me as being silent, but I can be very silent when I want to be. And there have been times that we've had wordless nights. We've played wordless games. And then I think, I'm really going to take it out on her. I'm really just going to see how long I can do this and make her suffer. And she's probably enjoying my silence, you know. And I got to be honest about it. When I feel like Connie wrongs me in some way today, which seldom ever happens, I still have that temptation to want to take my anger out in silence. And I venture to say there are couples here this morning, you haven't spoken to each other. You've not said one word to each other this morning. Now it's for you that Paul says, do not let the sun go down in your wrath. Don't do it, because anger can lead even to murder. We see it every day in our newspapers. If you don't deal with that anger, it can take such control of you that you can ultimately do some very tragic things that you will regret after you've done them. He said, don't let the sun go down in your wrath. The day of our anger should be the day that we deal with it. Otherwise, bitterness and thoughts of revenge begin to set in and terrible consequences come. Now, with Christ in our lives, we have the potential to deal with anger. I don't need to give you steps this morning on how to deal with anger. Paul says, put it away. Put it aside. Deal with it once and for all. He doesn't give 10 steps on how to do that. You may want 10 steps. I can't give you 10 steps this morning. All I know is you begin to practice putting it away. And once you begin to practice putting anger away, like you practice putting lying away, all at once you're going to develop a habitual life pattern of no longer lying and no longer being angry for a protracted period of time. But you've got to be determined that you're going to deal with it. And I hope you are this morning. If you've got anger in your heart against anyone, you ought to go to them when the service is over. If it's someone here in the church, you ought to deal with it right now. Say, what you did really offended me, but I forgive you, and I really want to restore that relationship. You ought to do that. Don't let it pass. Don't let that anger seethe and boil, and ultimately it does some terrible things. And then there's a third thing. He says, we must stop stealing and start working. Verse 28. Now, issues like this seem to be so incidental to us, and I realize there's some of you that are without work, you don't have a job, and for you this is very difficult, and I'm not speaking to you. I'm really not. You've tried to get a job, and I realize I want to be sensitive to this, because it's a difficult time in our economy. But the Greek word here, he says, let him who stole steal no more. The word is klepto, for steal. And it's the word from which we get our word kleptomaniac. A kleptomaniac is one who, even though he may be wealthy, and I knew a man back in Ohio, that very outstanding man in the community, well-known, respected, had absolutely no money needs, but he was a kleptomaniac. He just loved to see what he could steal. And that's someone who just has this, he's preoccupied with stealing. It's abnormal. It's persistent. He just has this penchant that drives him to steal, even though he doesn't need what he's stealing. And Paul is using this in a sense here, in the present verb here with the negative. It means stop doing what you are doing. In other words, stop an action that's in progress. What he was implying is there are some in the church at Ephesus who have a way of stealing. They're practicing stealing. I said, stop it. Just stop it. It's that simple. Just stop it. You have the power to stop it. If you begin to practice it, you begin to practice it now. I need not remind you that this touches upon the very heart and fabric of our nation today, this problem of stealing. It's become so gigantic, so enormous, that it really literally threatens to destroy the very economical base of our country. We have employers. We have businesses today that are on the very verge of ruin because of all the pilfering, not only by employees, but by customers who come through and take whatever they want. And we saw what happened in South Florida after the hurricane. California today is in a state of emergency, I heard last night on the news, because of workmen's compensation. And workmen compensation costs have gone literally to the sky because of all the fraudulent claims by employees, by lawyers, and by doctors who are turning in false reports. And businesses, therefore, are moving out of the state of California because they can no longer afford the high cost of workmen's comp. And we all know about the SNL scandals and all the fraudulent activity there. If you are in the habit of stealing, stop it. Now, what does this cover? Let me quickly list some no-nos that would come under the category of stealing. Just listen to them, and then examine your own heart and say, am I guilty in this area? Let me mention it. Shady bookkeeping. Adjusting the books to deprive the government. Cheating on your income taxes. Obtaining money under false pretenses. Stealing time from your employer. Not giving him an honest day's work. Intentional overestimating. Stealing by padding expense accounts. Falsified cost overruns. Reporting more hours than worked. Borrowing something and forgetting to return it. Getting too much change in return for your purchase and letting it go unnoticed as you go out of the store. The ways to steal in our society, they are almost endless. I saw a report of a man who was in prison, and while he was in prison, he stole, literally, more than $2 million worth of merchandise. You say, how's that possible? He would call numbers because he had a phone in his cell. He would call numbers, getting all of these credit card numbers, and then he would call and make all of these orders from all of these clearing houses. He would have it sent to many different destinations, and they estimated that before he was finally caught, he had stolen over $2 million worth of merchandise by using other people's credit card numbers. That ought to make you feel a little uneasy if you have a credit card this morning. It can be done. People can be so creative in how they steal. But the Christian can no longer steal. He has got to begin to develop a habitual life pattern of working for what he has need of. He's got to begin it. We've got to begin to practice that. And for some of us, that's just almost revolutionary because we've maybe never had to work because of parents who've had more than enough or all these other things. And so we have kids today that have never worked. They don't know what it's like to work. They've had no fathers who've been at home to show them how to work. And the end result is that everybody's out there stealing today. Not everybody, of course, but many. It's a major problem in our society. I even heard where airlines are threatened to go under because the employees are stealing all of the spare parts from airplanes, and then they find their way into the black market, and it's causing our airline tickets to go up, and it's causing airlines to almost go under today. Major problem. God intended that every man is to earn his living by the sweat of his brow. And it doesn't take much to sweat here in South Texas. You don't have to do a lot to sweat. The one thing you want to be sure of, notice Paul says, is that the work is good. Let him who stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good. Make sure that what you are involved in is good and wholesome for the Christian community. I don't see how you can be involved in distribution of beer. I don't see how you can be involved in the making of beer. You can't be involved as a Christian in pornography. You can't be involved in so many of these evils that are in our society. And if you are, then immediately resign and trust God to give you some other kind of employment. Paul says, do what is good. The word here means wholesome, good for society. Don't make your living by hurting others. Christians can't do that. Now, one of the purposes in God-given work is explained here in verse 28, and that is that we may have something to give to him who has need. We are to work so that we have something that we can give away. We're not to work so that we can just build up vast resources of money. We're not to work so we can just accumulate and hoard money. That's not what God has put us for here. He's put us here in order to be able to work so that we've got something to give. If you've got a lot of resources and you're retired and you've got more than enough, then you need to learn the art of giving. And I realize many of you have done that. But give generously. That's why God has given you what you have. Eugene Greaseman points out that patterns stored in memory are the key to competence in any field. A chess master learns to recognize from 15,000 to 50,000 possible patterns on a chessboard. The Christian life also involves developing patterns of obedience that become a natural part of our daily walk. And here are three patterns of behavior that ought to become a developing way of life for each one of us. And we're no longer lying to one another, but we're speaking the truth. We are no longer, according to verse 26, angry with one another without dealing with that anger. We are no longer in the process of stealing, but rather we're laboring with our own hands and we're working in something that is good and wholesome for society. And I would simply ask you, how do you measure up in this area? You see, the pressure in our society today is enormous to conform to what society is doing, and society is going in the wrong direction. It's headed for disaster. And unless we have Christ indwelling us and Christ becomes the focus of our life, there's no way that we can obey the commands that Paul gives us here. Absolutely no way. Most of us have probably stood at the edge of the Niagara Falls and watched as the water comes raging down the Niagara River, and then it reaches that precipice and it falls 180 feet below, and there's this all of this foam and spray, and it's just a beautiful sight. But probably most of us have never been back up the Niagara River. They say that the further, closer it gets to that precipice, the more rough, turbulent the waters are. And there are, back up a mile on the Niagara River, there are signs warning boaters. There is a pedestrian crossway that goes across the Niagara River just before it gets real rough. And on that pedestrian crossway, there is a sign that asks two questions. Do you have an anchor? And the second question is, right below it, do you know how to use it? And I would ask you this morning, do you have an anchor? Is Jesus Christ your anchor in life? And do you know how to use it? Because if we don't, in these days, we're going to be swept right along with the current, and we're going to be destroyed with the rest of humanity. I want us to bow in prayer. Do you have an anchor? Is Jesus Christ your anchor? Do you know how to use him, to lean upon him in those times of temptation? I would encourage you right now, you may be visiting, just indicate you would love to trust Christ. We've got prayer couples who will be up here at the end of the service that would love to meet with you. It'll be very inconspicuous. You just come. They'll be here. You may have a problem with lying this morning. You've been caught up in so much lying, you don't even know what the truth is anymore. You want to deal with that problem this morning. Maybe you need some help, some encouragement. You come. You got a problem with anger this morning? You're angry. You may be angry with me. You may be angry at the church. You may be angry at your husband, your wife, your children, your parents. You might be angry at an employee, an employer, a co-worker. You got to deal with it. You need help in dealing with it. You come. You got a problem with stealing? Your lifestyle is still too much like the lifestyle of a non-believer. Stealing has kind of become a way of life. If God's people are going to be effective in this generation, it's going to be because we present Christ in all of his love and truth to this generation. Father, I pray that you will speak to us. Help us to deal with these issues in our lives, that we may be men and women who are authentic Christians, who will have a major impact upon our society. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.